Yeah, thank you so much for asking. I mean, this is basically homegrown, crowdsourced, homemade Catholic art, and that means that we went outside of the studio system, and now as we're getting ready to distribute it, we're basically calling for the Catholic space again to buy out theaters, to get their parishes online and say, hey, we want to host a screening and we want to get a screening done in our area. Basically you can find more out about how to do that at triumphoftheheart.com. But essentially we get to be in theaters, but we only get to be in the theaters that that people buy out. Once somebody buys out a theater in their city, then we will get to be in that space for as long as the theatrical release happens. But if nobody buys out a theater in a city, then we won't end up opening the release there. We have to be very targeted and very limited. So that's basically what we're doing, is kind of calling people to help us to secure beachheads of hope, is what I'm calling it, by securing screenings in their cities.
I'm guessing that the promotion of it, the marketing of it, in many ways is as challenging as doing the movie itself. Have you found that to be the case? Now that it's, I guess done or mostly done, it's like, how do we get this out there? How do we get the word out? Is that a challenging part of the process?
I would say that it is at least as challenging, probably more challenging in different ways. We, shot this film in Poland, and so we had to bring people over to a country whose language we did not know and whose culture that we did not know in order to sort of chase down that authenticity. And that was very, very difficult. But, distributing a movie is even harder, especially when you're working outside of the studio space. Everything in this space is kind of made for big blockbusters, and it's not very friendly to, small Catholic indie productions. And so I think that really this is kind of a moment. This is a make or break moment for Catholic media in general, because I think that, we've made something together as a community. This is something that was like crowdfunded, crowdsourced, Catholic missionaries that were going out and sleeping on floors to make this thing happen. So it's coming out of the heart of the church. We really have to own it all the way through the final stage of getting it distributed.
I do have some specific questions about the movie itself, and I do encourage everybody who's listening right now to make it a priority to see this movie, and if possible, if you can do that, maybe buy out a theater or do whatever you can. All the information is on the website, triumphoftheheart.com, triumphoftheheart.com. I'm speaking to Anthony D'Ambrosio, writer and director of the movie, and his father and executive producer, Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio, as well. Dr. Marcellino, what is your role as executive producer, and tell me your own thoughts on the movie? I mean, I know you've seen it, but what how did it hit you?
Well, first of all, I'll just say that from the very beginning, in Anthony's story, as he's been praying about this and it's been on his heart, we've been talking about it together, and he's bounced ideas off me. So, like, we've kind of walked kind of accompaniment from the beginning there. Yeah. But I would just say this. So many Saints films, in my mind, fall into one or two categories. One is it's super sentimental, and I would say even can even veer in the direction of being a little corny or Pollyannish, and kind of super sweet, no problems, no difficulties. Saint never develops, Saint doesn't have any warts or wrinkles whatsoever, ever. I remember I was a friend of Mother Angelica's way back when, and started going to the studio to film in the 80s, and she was there. We had talks, and she once said that she just hated plaster statue saints and people making saints into figures that are unrelatable. She said, if anyone ever does that to me, I'm going to come back and haunt them. So anyway, that's one problem. The other problem is watering down the faith to try to make it appeal to a wider audience. I've seen movies that have been very excellent in production, but very shallow in depicting sanctity. And so to tell the story of the saints is one of the greatest responsibilities, the greatest challenges of any filmmaker. And I this is what we really wanted to see happen here. And I think Anthony and the team have done this. It is profoundly spiritual. It's profoundly moving. Anybody who watches this is going to walk away incredibly proud to be a Catholic, very, very proud of the priesthood, closer than Mary, but also really deeply challenged and equipped, I think. I think this movie equips people to be able to cope with suffering and the tough questions and help others who are struggling with those tough questions. The biggest question of all, St. Thomas Aquinas said this, in terms of argument against God that comes up again and again, is the problem of good people suffering. Mm-hmm. And this is what this movie is about, and it is just a masterpiece of victory, portraying the victory of the cross. And I think it's really awesome. It's coming out the weekend of the Triumph of the Holy Cross. That is really kind of, that wasn't done liturgically on our part, but I think God kind of arranged it to come out that weekend.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And you've got to be so proud of what Anthony and his team have put together, and you as well. Anthony, I want to ask you about some of the details of the movie, because I think one of the things that impressed me the most was the character development. Sometimes you watch a movie and you think, you know what, I never really got to know that person. I don't really know what to think. But as I see it, there's three main characters, and you tell me if you think I'm off track here. You've got, obviously, Maximilian Kolbe, you've got Albert, and then you've got the German Nazi leader, Karl Fritsch. Those are the three main characters, would you say, and can you talk a little bit about those three and how their lives kind of intertwined?
Yeah, so one of the things that I think is really important about telling the stories of the saints, and I think partly is what is missed when other films have tried to depict the holiness of saints, is that it's very, very hard to depict them directly. It's much easier to depict them through the perspective of another person whose life they changed, because in that way you get to sort of be a spectator and to be connected to the saint through that character's eyes. And so I picked this character, Albert, who's a POW in Auschwitz. There were many political prisoners in Auschwitz at the time, Kolbe being one of them, and many other POWs who had been arrested and captured and sent to die in the prison along with him. And so one of the characters that I really focused on was a young man who had a great love, a great patriotism and an idealism, and who ultimately is just totally broken by the experience of the trauma of the war, and who is in total despair, and who, as soon as he's thrown into this cell, wants to go ahead and promote the idea of collective suicide, that they should all kill themselves rather than endure the suffering of this, you know, terrible end. And Kolbe, being who he is, basically begins to advocate for this man's life and to minister to him. And through the course of the movie, ultimately, you know, brings him to a really beautiful and heroic death. And he, of course, is sort of the perspective that I had. The reason why that character is so, I think, personal and human is just because that was my story in many ways, that as somebody who is sick and ill and needing to find a reason to hope and a reason to live, when I discovered Kolbe's story, I really felt like Kolbe entered into my cell and began to minister to me, and this movie is really the fruit of that. And you also asked about the character of Karl Fritsch, the commandant in this movie that condemns Kolbe to die and is sort of his nemesis through the course of the movie. And I thought Nazis are very, very difficult to write. They're always these sort of mustache-twisting, just like two-dimensional evil people. And I think what I wanted to do was to show how both Fritsch and Kolbe in many ways were two sides of the same page. They were both people who cared a lot about media and propaganda, and of course, like, you know, creating a sort of a message that was being broadcast. Fritsch's was this culture of death and of power and of dominance, and Kolbe's was a message of hope and of healing and of peace. And ultimately, I think that charting through the two of their stories, we get to see Fritsch lose his family and ultimately lose his career. And his final end was really ignominious and terrible. Whereas Colby, as he suffers, he comes closer to love and to the other men that he's ministering to, and ultimately to heaven. And I think that there's a poetic justice in the way that we told both of their stories and laced them kind of through the course of the movie.
And I thought the acting was remarkable. And my wife and I were both saying the same thing. Like, where did you find these people? I mean, the gentleman who played Colby himself was just a beautiful actor. And all of these actors were just outstanding. How in the world did you go about to find these? Because they'd have to mostly be foreign people, right?
It was very hard. And, you know, we were putting out a casting call to something that was completely unreasonable, if that makes sense. Like, the only people who would want to do this are people who had some sort of deep desire to connect with the story, because it was so hard. We were paying something like $150 a day. They all had to shave their heads, which for an actor really means they can't take the other roles that normally they take. And they had to starve themselves, be on 1,000-calorie diet a day. They had to lose 20 pounds and perform these incredibly, incredibly emotionally difficult scenes. And so the only people who were attracted to that were people who had some sort of deep desire to connect with Colby and with the story. And I will say that the story of my connection with the actor that played Maximilian Colby himself, he was a raging alcoholic. He was a Polish star who lost his marriage, his family, through the course of his addiction. And when he hit rock bottom, he was in AA, and he found the Lord there, and ultimately made this relationship with Colby, because Colby is the patron saint of addicts. And being, you know, a Pole, and being an alcoholic, he really found solace in that story and in Colby's life. And when he heard that there was a movie coming to film that story, he immediately wanted to become a part of it. And so it was just an immediate meeting, I guess, of God's plan of redemption, both over my life and his life. And when we came together, I knew I didn't have to audition him. Within 30 seconds, I knew that he was it, that he knew the man of Colby that I had known, and that both of us had been shaped by that friendship.
Yeah, you know, there's a quote by Matt Walsh on the website. He said, deeply powerful, unflinching, brilliantly written and acted. And wow, what a great testimony from Matt Walsh there. And there's some others that I'm going to mention as well. One thing, Anthony, I want to ask you is, you know, you've got these 10 men, you know, starving to death in a cell. All of them, I think, died, you know, and there's so much dialogue and there's so much interaction that's going on between these men, and it's beautifully written and beautifully acted. How much of that was, is there any kind of historical evidence of what went on in that cell, or was that a lot of creative license, or tell me about that.
Yeah.
What do we know about what happened in there?
You know, there's a character in the movie who is sort of this janitor character that goes in every morning to check to see if there are any dead bodies to remove them from the cell to deter, you know, cannibalism. And so this character is actually a real life character. And he was interviewed many, many times during the course of the canonization process of Maximilian Colby. And so we have an eyewitness account to what happened inside of the cell, not necessarily to the specifics of what was said in the cell, but the story beats that we have in the movie are ultimately inspired by his testimony. And this overall sort of structure of the movie, where we see Colby coming in and all the men are divided, and they're in this place of like, it sounds like hell. You know, you hear the screams of tortured men throughout the course of the movie in echoing across the halls. And throughout the course of Colby singing in his ministry, all of the other cellmates begin to pick up the song and to sing it for the other prisoners outside their windows. And this was an actual thing that did happen. And people who were there and who heard it said that thousands of people's lives, were saved by the hope that was injected into them through these songs. So we don't know specifically who was in the cell with Kolbe, but we do know who was in Auschwitz at the time, and all the characters are really written according to the demographics of Auschwitz and its composition.
All right, well, thank you for that. Marcelino, can you tell our listeners about the funding aspect of this? Anthony mentioned about the crowdfunding, the kickstart that kind of got things going. I know Jeff Scheffelbein and Undivided Life and Nick Besner are mentioned in the credits as well. How did this get funded, and what, from a funding standpoint, is still needed to bring this to completion?
Sure. Well, first of all, you have to fund production, and usually you start with investors, and people invest money as a business act. And there are a number of people who did that, but instead of huge, big investors who are looking at this as a business, all the people who invested, I think, invested because they believe in the movie. And it was mainly a lot of small investments, of modest investments of people of you know, $5,000 and $10,000 and $20,000. And then we found out something remarkable. Lots of folks didn't want to invest. They just wanted to give. And so Crossroads, my ministry is actually, the name of us is Crossroads Productions. And Crossroads Productions was founded in 1988 to proclaim the gospel through all forms of media and the performing arts. So our board said, hey, this is great. This is a call from the Lord. We want to make it possible to do grants for people to give to us. We give to the production company. So a lot of money was given. And again, it was people giving in little amounts, and so a few people giving from in large amounts. People, you know, and then now we're in a position where we're trying to finish funding the marketing. And we need, I just talked to the team the other day, I think we need another $175,000. And people can make loans that'll be paid back with interest, or they can make a grant and make a gift. So we definitely can use all the help we can get to get this across the finish line. I think what we need even more than that is for people to step up and decide to help get a screening going in their area. I think the point I want to make is how easy we have, just a phenomenal team, technical team that has worked on this, but a system was set up where people can put their zip code in. If you go to kolbemovie.com, kolbemovie.com, you put your zip code in to see if there's a screening around you. And if there is, you can buy tickets and support that. And if it's not, you can start one by buying 5 tickets. Like $89, you can start the process of booking a theater in your area. I think that's within reach of anybody in any community. So I really encourage people to go to kolbemovie.com and to get the process started, to bring it to your neighborhood or supporting one that's already going.
All right. Thank you. kolbemovie.com. Thanks for telling us that. I had mentioned also triumphoftheheart.com, and you can find information there. But kolbemovie.com is the website to go to. And Anthony, you know, there's probably some people that are like, you know, I don't know if I can stand a movie like this, watching guys, you know, suffer and die in a cell. And the movie is very poignant and very powerful and very sad and tragic in many ways. But I want to ask you about, first of all, I don't want to give away the ending, but I thought the ending was just outstanding. It's such a payoff, you know, for what your the viewer is put through in the movie, where it is sad and it's tragic and it's, you know, but then the ending I just think is fabulous. And and then also just the message of hope. What would you say to somebody who is maybe reluctant to go to a movie where they're gonna be made sad throughout it?
it is such a amazing question, because most people, I think, are reluctant to go and see The Passion of the Christ, right? It's a heavy moment, and it's utilized in a different way than entertainment is usually utilized. I think our entertainment and our kind of American experience of that is usually as a distraction from kind of the sufferings of our life. The amazing thing about, I think, what Catholic art is supposed to be is an immersion into the story of the gospel. And of course, to be immersed in the story of Jesus Christ is not necessarily a pleasant experience. You know, we're called to pick up our crosses and to carry them. And what that really means is to be immersed in the story of Christ's crucifixion. And the loving and most beautiful thing about God is that he does not leave us alone in those crosses and in that suffering. When he asks us and invites us to to look upon his crucifix and his crucified body, not only is there a gift of love in that his presence is there with us in our suffering, but that also it is an act of hope that he's leading the way, because beyond that suffering is heaven. And Colby himself had a dream that changed the entire way that he looked at the world and that he related with it. And this was a dream about heaven. And he never really wrote exactly what it was. He didn't give any details about the dream, just that when he was in Japan and he was on death's door, he had this dream that really reshaped his perspective. And he comes back and you see the tone of his letters changing. They become very tender, and he's using sort of pet names for the people that he's writing to. And you see this unbelievable endurance of suffering in him, and he attributes that to his vision of heaven. So I won't tell you what the ending is, but I will tell you that we leave you with that promise of heaven in a way that will make all of the suffering of the movie worth it, that you will be crying with joy at the very end as you get to see the payoff of the reward of martyrdom.
Yeah, and all the flashback scenes and just the artistry is absolutely beautiful. We are out of time. I do want to close out by, first of all, thanking Anthony D'Ambrosio, writer and director of this beautiful movie, Triumph of the Heart. Go to ColbyMovie.com. Make sure Colby's with a K, ColbyMovie.com. And also Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio, dad and also executive producer of the movie. Emily Malloy of The Federalist says it's a deeply powerful movie, unflinching. Oh, I'm sorry, that's Matt Walsh. Okay. She says the dominant artistic technique in Triumph of the Heart is like a Caravaggio masterpiece reemerging after 500 years. You know, Emily Malloy of The Federalist. That is a great testimony. Thank you to you both. I really appreciate the time you spent in the interview. And I just ask everybody to pray, support, and go to that website, ColbyMovie.com, and do what you can. Thanks to you both, and God bless you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you.
All right. Thank you. This has been the Interview of the Week here on the Guadalupe Radio Network. And I appreciate you listening. God bless you. Have a great rest of your weekend.
The St. Anne Catholic community is excited to announce its 32nd annual carnival. The St. Anne Community Carnival will be held on Friday evening, September 5th, through Sunday afternoon, September 7th, at St. Anne Parish in Coppell. All are invited. Enjoy thrilling carnival rides, exciting games, live music, entertainment, delicious food, and much more. Bring your family and friends for a fun-filled weekend. For more information, visit carnival.stannparish.org. That's carnival.stannparish.org.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this edition of the GRN Interview of the Week here on the Guadalupe Radio Network. We're glad you are with us, and we are so excited to now be broadcasting on not only 910 AM in the Dallas area, but also KCPP 1140 AM in Fort Worth, 101.5 FM, our little station in Cleburne, the GRN app, and also on our live stream at grnonline.com. And I'm very excited about this interview because, as you know, this we have an eclectic array of guests on this interview. If it's local and Catholic, we love to talk to people and introduce you to folks that maybe you're not aware of. And rarely do I talk to CEOs of huge companies, but that is the case. My guest is Charlie Morrison, and he, as of April 28th of this year, became the CEO of Jersey Mike's restaurant chain. They have 3,100 chains restaurants across the U.S. and Canada, and he also is a parishioner at Good Shepherd Parish in Colleyville, one of our most supportive parishes there in the Fort Worth Diocese. And so I do want to thank Ed Gray. Ed is the one who is a friend of Charlie's, and he made this introduction. So I'm thankful for Ed Gray for that. Charlie Morrison, thanks for taking some time with us. Nice to speak with you.
It's great to be here, Dave. Thank you.
Yeah, and I know obviously we want to talk about your career and Jersey Mike's, but I'd like to start off just outside of all that. Of course, the most important thing is faith and family. Can you tell us a little bit about your family? Do you have children, a wife, anything personal about yourself?
Sure, I'd be happy to. My wife, Debbie, and I have been together and married for 35 years. We have four beautiful children. They are all four grown, raised off on their own, and married to amazing, amazing people that they've met and developed their own families with. And we have, from them, seven beautiful grandchildren. Our most recent one was born just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, we've a good big Catholic family for sure. And we're very blessed with that.
And did you grow up in this area or are you a transplant? How long have you been in North Texas?
Yeah, Debbie and I have been here since about 2001. It was our second stint in North Texas, but we both grew up in the state of Kansas. She was from Kansas City. I'm from Wichita, Kansas, originally. And we met in college, and we got married in college. Before we graduated, our first of our four were born. And so we've been bouncing around the country for a lot of years prior to 2001 with company moves and everything that goes with that with different companies. So, but Texas has been our home now for about the past 24, 25 years.
Yeah, very nice. Both my daughters work in the service industry. One is at Cane's and the other one is at serving as a waitress at a sports bar. And so I know just from their experience that, you know, the restaurant industry is fast moving and, you really be on top of it. But to be a CEO of such a large chain, it must just be surreal. And a very busy lifestyle, especially when you've got the four kids and the grandkids and the personal life as well. So I'd like to talk about that. But from a professional standpoint, you know, you have really spent decades in the restaurant industry. I know you were very instrumental in the success of Wingstop over the last 10 years or so, 2012 to 2022, and also a board member and CEO of Salad and Go. How did it start for you to choose this industry to work in the beginning?
Well, it was a bit by fate. When I graduated college, my focus and emphasis coming out of school was in MIS or, you know, data sciences and programming, things like that. And I had a friend at Pizza Hut, which was headquartered at the time in Wichita, Kansas, which now is also a North Texas company. And he said, hey, there's a job available, and it's programming in this sophisticated programming language. And your job is to basically identify, use code to write programs that would identify incidences of theft and manipulation within the system of all the restaurants across the country. And I said, okay, well, I think I can pull that off. And so I actually started my career by writing code and working on data and information. And what was interesting about that is it actually became a real critical piece to my ultimate success in the restaurant business. So I was predominantly a finance person and an analyst as I grew up through the organizations that I was a part of between Pizza Hut and Boston Market and others. And then ultimately became an operator and a CEO over time. And so, you know, sometimes you start as dishwashers, sometimes you start in different areas. But for me, my career really centered on my analytical abilities, I guess, and coming up through the finance track where I got to see the whole business. And then ultimately was blessed with the opportunity of taking the reins and running a couple of companies through my career and growing from there.
Yeah. One of the things that really is highlighted in the press release that was sent out, and perhaps one of the top reasons why they wanted you to lead, you know, Jersey Mike's, is the success you had at Wingstop, growing from 500 stores to over 2,000 locations, 10 countries. What is the secret for expansion like that? And that's pretty explosive growth over, you know, 10 years. So what was the strategy there?
Yeah, I think, you know, a company like this that is going to see that kind of success probably has a couple of key characteristics to it. That's that, you know, first, a product that people love and enjoy and get excited about. And everybody loves chicken wings. They're on almost every menu in America.
Yeah.
But what we had was a brand that was centered just on that product and making it a center of the plate item, so a meal rather than a snack or an appetizer. And it was a really indulgent occasion for folks. I mean, you're not eating it for the, you know, the calorie reduction diet or anything else, but you're eating it because you love it, and it's a great food, just like barbecue or anything else. And so we had something unique. We also really had a business that was by itself in a category alone. And so there really wasn't a real competitor. There are brands out there like Buffalo Wild Wings and others that sell chicken wings, but nothing like Wingstop. And then the business has to be portable. So it has to work everywhere and in a lot of places in order for you to be successful and grow at the pace that you did. So it has to demonstrate that it's not just a Northeastern Buffalo, New York type of concept, or, you know, a Dallas, if you think of Wingstop and its origins. But it has to be transportable everywhere and portable in that regard. And then with that, you have to have great unit economics that franchisees really love, so that they'll build out a lot of them. And that predictability of building it was also critical to the success. And so we put all of that together, enhanced it with a very rich culture within the organization, with great people and great talent and great franchisees. And that ultimately, you put it all together and put it in the pot, and it's a great recipe for extraordinary success, which they've had for many years, even since I've left. And I'm very happy to see that.
Yeah, very nice. My guest is Charlie Morrison. He is the newly appointed CEO of Jersey Mike's Franchise Systems, and he is local here. He and his wife, Debbie, and are parishioners at Good Shepherd Parish in Colleyville, and as he mentioned before, 4 children, 7 grandchildren, so busy life, and also managing 3,100 franchises across the U.S. and Canada. And Charlie, one of the things that really struck me about the information, you know, the press release, is that you are taking over Jersey Mike's after a 50-year, what they call a career-building, career of, and I hope I pronounce his name right, Peter, is it Cancro?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, Peter Cancro, and that, to me, seems pretty intimidating to take over from really what's a legendary figure with this franchise. How is that, you know, taking over from a legend like that? I'm sure he's of great assistance to you even today.
He is, and a legend is the appropriate description for Peter. He's a fantastic human being, one of the more generous human beings I've ever met in my career as well. He was the single sole shareholder of the company for 50 years. There's an excellent story about just true entrepreneurial spirit with Peter as well. He actually bought the first store, which was a little sub shop in Point Pleasant, New Jersey, by way of the assistance from a coach of his on his football team to get a loan to buy out the store that he was working in when the original owner was wanting to sell or get out of the business. And as a 17-year-old, he started the chain and built it 50 years later to, you know, one of the largest chains in the food industry, and certainly one of the most recognizable and successful. And it's an amazing story. He from that $120,000 investment he made, he sold it for $8 billion. And you don't see those very often. But yet what you find is this nice, humble gentleman who cares deeply about people, about the products that he sells, and the culture and the commitment and care to the organization. And so it was a blessing for me to meet him and get to know him. We hit it off very well because we communicate effectively. And I think that was a critical piece to anyone being successful in following the footsteps of a founder like that and filling those big shoes. But to this point, I'm only about 10 weeks into the job. I will tell you that we talk quite often, I would say on average every other day. And, we talk about the history, about the what's and why's, how things were developed and built. And it's been a great relationship so far, and I anticipate it being that way well into the future.
Yeah, I'm sure you've been asked this before, but obviously Peter is the one that grew the franchise and bought the original one, like you said. But Jersey Mike, is Mike still in the picture, or who is the original founder?
Yeah, so the original store was called Mike's Subs and Sub Shop in Point Pleasant, and Peter was working there. But then he maintained the name, so I do not know Mike, nor do I know if Mike actually is still around, to be honest with you. But Peter is, you know, credited certainly with the development of it. And then they expanded the name to Jersey Mike's so that it had, you know, that cachet of growing it across the country. So it was a slight addition that was made to Mike Subs later on.
Yeah, and I think about the industry. You talked about Wingstop being kind of unique and not having a lot of competitors, but I think in the sandwich industry, like what you're in now, there are a lot of competitors, you know, with Jimmy John's and Potbelly and, you know, Jason's Deli and all the, it's a pretty busy type of restaurant field. Would you agree? And what kind of sets you all apart? What makes you different?
I do agree there is a lot of competition for sub sandwiches and sandwiches in general. There are very large players like Subway and others out there that we compete with. But I've always had a fundamental belief that what we should be competing for are eating occasions as much as we are against other sub sandwich players, because otherwise you get yourself in a position where you're just trying to pit your product against theirs and the quality and everything. And I think the key for us is to maintain what has gotten us to the point we are at today and not losing sight of how we got there in the first place. And a lot of that centers on the fact that we really haven't changed much in a long, long time with this brand. We still, if you walk into a Jersey Mike's, you'll see that you're met and greeted by a smiling face who's excited to take care of you, and you can order your favorite sub. And that we have a deli case on the line full of all the deli meats ready to be sliced and the cheeses to be sliced. We bake the bread fresh every single morning, sometimes twice a day, to make sure that freshness and quality are there. We hand slice tomatoes in the stores. We hand cut our lettuce and onions. We pay careful attention to our Mike's way of what we call sprinkling and supporting the sandwich with lettuce, tomato, onion, vinegar, oil, and our seasonings. Putting all that together, the theater of that and the demonstration of real quality is really what I think sets Jersey Mike's apart. I mean, the subs are fantastic. And then I would say, you know, if you compare size and quantity of product that you're going to get for a great value at Jersey Mike's, it's really hard to beat that with any other sub chain that's out there.
And do you, you know, expansion, we talk about Wingstop and just that amazing expansion. As you look, you know, forward 5 or 10 years, what are your goals? It looks like you're mostly in America and Canada. Do you want to have international expansion or more, you know, stores in the U.S.? Or what are some of the goals that you have for the coming years?
Yeah, I think we have a lot of runway, or what I call white space, in both the U.S. and certainly around the world. We just expanded into Canada a little over a year ago. We've had great success in our starting point there in Canada, and a great partner there that's working with us to build that market out. I do believe this brand has that portability, the ability to go into many markets around the world. And that is something that we'll focus our efforts on. But even within the United States, we're in all 50 states today and have plenty of territory available to continue to grow the business here as well. So there's a long trajectory of growth ahead of us. We were acquired by Blackstone, which is the world's largest private equity company. And the partners of Blackstone and I agree that we think this brand has, you know, all the potential to be a really successful company for a long time to come.
The month before you were hired on, according to the press release, you had the 15th annual month of giving, $30 million raised for charities, a total of $143 million given to a couple hundred charities since 2011. Tell us about that, and is that something that you're going to continue as CEO?
Well, absolutely, we'll continue it. And I mentioned earlier, when in describing Peter Cancro, a man of extraordinary generosity, and he really believes in giving back into the communities that we serve through Jersey Mike's. The Day of Giving is real. It's all of our franchise partners as well as the company engaging in one day to take all of our revenue and give it back to local markets. And And I agree and align with Peter philosophically that, you know, the giving starts at home and in the communities in which we serve. And so we've done a fantastic job as a company over the years of really demonstrating a sincere desire to support it. A good example, we try to not only just give back that one day a year, but we always are working to give back in communities. And with the recent flooding in Central Texas, just yesterday, we put out onto our app and in our stores, we have a donate and give back program where customers can, you know, give $1 or $3 or $5 on every transaction. And we're going to be supporting the Central Texas community to raise money to, support the relief efforts down there. So it's integrated into the culture and purpose of this company, and it'll be something that we'll certainly carry forward well into the future.
Yes. I imagine, you know, work-personal balance is something that a person in your position really has to keep on track. With, you know, the four children, grown children, seven grandkids and a wife and, you know, church life, how do you find that balance and also having a pretty, you know, high-pressure job, I imagine?
Yeah, well, I think the key is being thoughtful and careful about committing your time and where you want to commit that and prioritizing it. And so you actually hit on the key elements aside from an occasional game of golf. That's where I focus my time is my family with my grandkids and our faith and, you know, a little bit of an opportunity to get out and enjoy what I do best or love best, which is, you know, playing golf or just, you know, the exercise. I find great joy in the work I do. I find incredible joy in being with my family and our grandchildren. And so we have two of our children live here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Two live in Kansas City, and we have a family ranch in Kansas. So we go back and forth to a lot. So you'll find us, Debbie and I, always in and around the area. You know, with our family first as our first priority. And we found that balance to be good. I am commuting to New Jersey back and forth right now. That's added a different wrinkle to it. But, you know, we just make sure that we find that time and dedicate it so that we have our time together as well and work doesn't consume at all.
And well, what about your Catholic faith, your life at the parish? Can you talk about that and how you're able to incorporate some of the things you've learned from your faith into the position as CEO of Jersey Mike's?
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge for any leader to thoughtfully incorporate their faith into their everyday life without, you know, anyone coming to you and saying, well, I think you're overplaying your faith and you're pushing us, you know, pushing it upon us too hard. That's not how I do it. But what I do try and incorporate is the principles of our faith. And, you know, I'm obviously a follower of Christ, and I believe in, you know, the concepts of following his way in everything that we do, work or otherwise. And it's that which I demonstrate that I think people can attract themselves to if I'm leading my life and both my work life and my home life in that way. And so, you know, I've tried to, you know, incorporate that without having to be overt about it. But people will who know me know that I'm a man of faith. They know that we go to Mass every weekend. Now, it might be in New Jersey some weekends. It might be in Manhattan, Kansas. It might be here at Good Shepherd. But our faith life is important to us. And so that's the beauty of the Catholic faith is that no matter where you are, the Mass and the liturgy of the Eucharist are one and the same everywhere we go. The homilies might be a little different. The homilists might be a little different, right? But at the end of the day, all of it is really centered. And that's the beauty of our faith anywhere in the world we go. And so I think principally in the work life, one of the people that I admire most in terms of establishing the principles of leadership that make the most sense in this world is a guy named Patrick Lencioni, who you may know and know well as a good Catholic, but also a great leader, a shaper of leaders, if you will, somebody who shapes great leadership. And I follow a lot of his principles, which center on developing trust, being vulnerable, being honest and you know, bringing your full self to work so that you can be super effective and build effective teams that way. And so I try to find other ways, you know, even through the works of Lencioni, to bring those into the company as a means to advance and have success.
Yeah, thanks for that. Just a couple minutes remaining. I'm just curious, the day of the life, you talk about a lot of travel between the Dallas area and Kansas and New Jersey. Well, what's a typical day for you as CEO of Jersey Mike's?
Yeah, well, it starts early. It's kind of being a CEO of a company like this is almost a 24/7 job, although I don't work 24 hours a day. It usually starts early. Deb and I spend, if we're home together, we spend time in our gardens and walking around and just reflecting, and that's our start to every day. After that, then it's the litany of meetings back and forth, all day long, covering all the ground I need to. Some of it involves travel on any given day, going out, visiting franchisees, seeing stores, visiting, you know, partners, suppliers. The rhythm I've created here is about a 1 week on, 1 week off visit to New Jersey to spend time in our corporate offices. So, but it's, you know, life of the CEO, you have to find balance wherever you can get it. And it's not usually as structured as you'd like it to be, so you have to force it. But by the evening time, commitment to dinner and being with Debbie and the family is important, and picking up where I have to for the work responsibilities falls into that from time to time. So I'd love to say it's super structured 9 to 5, but it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I imagine. So I'm gonna put you on the spot after I say a couple of quick things. Is if somebody walks into a Jersey Mike's, what do you recommend on the menu? So I'll give you a chance to think about that for a second. If somebody, but I just want to remind everybody that I've been speaking to Charlie Morrison, the new, as of April of this year, CEO of Jersey Mike's Franchise Systems. We're about to have Jersey Mike's ourselves because I ordered it for a committee meeting that we're going to have this morning here, and we've ordered it a number of times before. It's an awesome chain, and it's quite an honor to speak to the CEO, and of course pray for him, pray for his wife Debbie and their kids and grandkids, and for the success of this company. And by the way, the website, jerseymikes.com, jerseymikes.com, there's a lot of franchises right here in North Texas. So, all right, Charlie, I've given you a little chance. When you walk into a Jersey Mike's, what do you order?
Oh, it's a number 13 Mike's Way. That 13 is the original. Many people will know that
okay.
One.
Okay.
It's a number 13 original Mike's Way, but add banana peppers to it. And, that's the best way to do it. And I highly recommend any of our hot subs as well. Our Philly cheesesteak rivals even the best of the Philly cheesesteak. So there's really nothing on the menu I wouldn't recommend, but number 13, right?
Number 13,
off the bat.
Okay. Easy. That's not the unlucky number in your case, is it?
No, that's the original. Absolutely.
Yeah, praise God. Okay, Charlie, thank you so much. Also want to thank again Ed Gray for making this connect.
Thanks for listening to KATH 910 AM Frisco Dallas Fort Worth on the Guadalupe Radio Network in North Texas. Catholic radio for your soul. Heard also at grnonline.com and on your smartphone.